and to kind of orient, I know we have some guests here today. So the meeting is recorded, we post it online, part of the District Open Meetings Act. So just be aware of that. The microphone's kind of spaced out. We have on the phone right now Paul Butler, one of our members, and right now that's it. Kevin Whitfield from the council may join us a little bit later, I believe by phone, kind of depends. They have a council hearing this morning that he's, committee oversight hearing that he's on, and no word from Helder. So I think we will go ahead and get started, and I think we should introduce ourselves, and maybe I will actually start with Blake down here. Blake's our spring legal intern. I'll let him introduce himself, where he's at school, and anything else you'd like to say.
Sure. I'm a 2L at Georgetown. I'm interested in criminal justice reform. I'm expert in the CCRC, so I wanted to see what the policy side of things look like. So, excited to be here.
Happy to have him. And Janu, you want to we'll go down this way?
It's Janu Park. I'm just one of the staff attorneys here with the CCRC.
Patrice Sultan, staff attorney.
Richard Schmeckel.
Michael Stroda, one of the staff attorneys.
Rachel Ricker, one of the staff attorneys.
Kenya Davis, with the U.S. Attorney's Office for D.C. and co-chair of the Human Trafficking Task Force for D.C.
Ilana Suttenberg at the U.S. Attorney's Office for D.C.
Sharon Marcus Turn, the Chief of the Sex Offense and Domestic Violence Section of the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Renata Cooper, U.S. Attorney's Office, D.C.
Katia Seminova, Public Defender Service.
Laura Hankins, PDS.
Dave Rosenthal, OAG.
Don Brayman from the George Washington University Law School
Paul, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Paul Butler. I'm from Georgetown Law School.
Great. Excellent. Well, thank you all for being here. Again, Kevin from the Council's Judiciary Committee may join us a bit later. All right. So, a few announcements before we get going. Obviously, we had to cancel the January meeting and then the rescheduled January meeting, but hopefully we will be all available here going forward. No more shutdowns in the...
I think if you declare an emergency...
Is that right?
Yeah,
is that going to work?
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Then we can come in.
Right, we have a kind of an extra full agenda because we pulled over January, added it here. Written comments for the current group of offenses out, escape, tampering, etc. Was set for March 1st, so still almost a month away. That's Friday. And our next meeting is set for kind of the regular first Wednesday of the month, March 6th. If folks aren't going to be available for that, please let me know in advance. Let's see, just to kind of give a bit of an overview of where things kind of go next. I think we've discussed before, you know, drug offenses, weapon possession offenses are on the table generally this spring, summer. Welcome any advanced comments anybody has. We also, though, in March, so we get back the written comments on this current group of offenses fairly quickly, then we're gonna try to turn around not only an update reflecting those comments, but we're trying to put together an across-the-board update on offenses today, right? So on many, many offenses, we haven't done a second draft that incorporates, you know, advisory group comments. So that a kind of across-the-board update will be released some point in March, exact date to be decided. And so that'll be the next kind of set of documents. And it's going to be huge in the sense of a lot of language, a lot of commentary, but also narrow in the sense of most of it's a tweaked version of things you've seen before, right? So really the issue is just the tweaks and where to go from there. Yeah.
So will it look like the last one that you sent out where it's all red rule to show the changes from one to another? Or
so yeah, we're doing a couple of things to try to just keep all the cats herded. There are a lot, we realize. So the organization will probably be a bit different. We're going to try to like sew together, what are now kind of broken up into, you know, many distinct draft reports into fewer draft documents. So there'll be commentary draft documents. There'll still be, and that will unite, for instance, offenses against persons, property offenses, et cetera. So those, rather than being in separate reports, you're going to have a big, chunky report that covers these kinds of what we've organized into subtitles, right? There will also, again, be the compilation of just the plain statutory language, right? Which is like a useful thing to have, you know, here's everything that we have to date for just the statutory language. There will be a red-lined, inked-up version kind of that shows changes to the statutory language compared to prior versions. And there will also be a document that kind of individually addresses all the comments, right, that are addressed in the update. Okay. So, and that'll be kind of a cheat sheet, right, because, you know, that's what the update is based on. There will also be an appendix with putting together, again, really just gluing together all the advisory group comments so far, right? Because again, even I'm sure your own filing systems have been challenged. Ours have been, right? But just the number of documents. So we'll put those together again into one document that compiles all the written comments today. So it'll begin to like make it a bit easier, I hope, to see where the status of things for moving forward. And begin to see kind of, you know, where the final version is going to look like in terms of organization formatting. But the main thing is a chance to kind of, again, look at things across the board, see what changes have been made, and that'll, again, come out in March. Probably mid to late March, I will say. More at this point, not sure, and how long a period of review there might be on that document also remains to be seen. We've got, looking forward to the summer and fall, our timelines are, we have a lot to do, and so we're pressed for time. So I'll do what I can in giving you as much time as possible, but again, that'll come out in March. Today's agenda, again, very long, so we never kind of quite know how much people may or may not want to discuss on different matters. So I was going to first kind of start with a little, kind of just a straw poll on the current draft reports out for review. So, escape, tampering, contraband, etc. Did people have like a significant amount of comments on those? Again, they're out. We're happy, as always, to meet individually, right, with offices to discuss questions or concerns about any offenses. But just to kind of gauge how we can run this meeting and get through everything, I wanted to check on the back end for the second half of the agenda. Are there particular offenses that people think they're going to want to spend significant time on? Anything in particular? Okay. I know we've had some conversations with some of you already.
Yeah, I'm sure we all have a couple of things, but nothing like today's stuff.
Okay. So then, good. Well, we'll see how far we're able to get. And I guess, again, in the interest of trying to get through as much as possible, what's most useful for the full group discussion versus, again, any individual discussions you might want to have with staff to, like, kind of provide comments. Definitely encourage, any meetings or calls or anything of that sort you'd like to. All right. No more questions. We'll go ahead and go to the top of the agenda for the comments that we had on the report number 26, the sexual assault and related provisions. I will pull up on the screen the statutory language. I think it might be the easiest thing to do. And open it up for discussion. I might preface by saying, two things. There are a lot of, good comments. I don't think we had any difficulty kind of understanding where everybody was coming from on them. So I don't know that there's anything we want to affirmatively raise. There was also, I want to make sure, we updated the written comments to add on a kind of a half page on the end that had kind of inadvertently gotten clipped from the OAG comments on, was it arranging? So just make sure everybody had that most current version that was sent out mid-January, the updated version. So additional kind of comments or questions on the feedback that was circulated?
I found a typo in ours.
Shame. On page 5, it says and, it seems they were. I just don't know if you didn't know. Can I underline the word? How is that?
Good. Well, sometimes there's perhaps so much that people want to say, then, people don't say anything. That's fair. Good. Well, I honestly, Rachel, were there any points that, we needed to clarify? I feel like, we had some conversations with, OAG and PDS on, following up on it. I think, comments were pretty clear. There's not too much conflict amongst the points raised, but obviously some different priorities and,
if you guys have a grasp and don't need to discuss the Barron's recommendation, that's fine. That's not to say that my necessarily sitting silent means that I agree with everything that other people submitted to the commission.
Sure.
But I'm happy to discuss any of that stuff if you want.
Yeah, I suspect everybody's happy to discuss others, but question is whether anybody wants to...
I just wanted to say silence doesn't mean agreement.
Fair enough.
Clearly that's the case with our office as well.
Fair enough. I take that as a standing presumption.
I do have a question. This is Sharon. So I see on the definition of sexual act and what you're doing with that, you dramatically narrowed the scope of the intent so that it's all now a sexual purpose. The U.S. Attorney's Office, we haven't really... We're still trying to, formulate a position about this, and we obviously haven't submitted any written comments yet. But kind of wondered what the thinking was about that, given that there's plenty of extremely serious case sexual assaults that we have where either the victim cannot see the defendant, there's one going on right now in court, we cannot prove that the assailant is sexually aroused, could be that the assailant has issues with having an erection or chooses not to say anything, chooses not to breathe hard. Nevertheless, it's an extremely serious sexual act. So I'm just wondering what the thinking was about.
Can you clarify? So if the definition of sexual act that got up on the screen, that's your question or point of reference?
So now in the proposal on page 35, the sexual act is only with the intent to
sexually degrade, arouse, or ratify the person. So it's exclusively for sexual. And as you know, historically it had been seen to abuse, humiliate, degrade, harass, etc. I wondered why the need to make that change.
Sure. And
whether there's any benefits of that change.
You bet. You bet.
I think our thinking was that the abuse, humiliate, and harass that has been deleted would be covered by the revised assault statute or offensive physical contact, and just making this clearly sexual since it does carry registration and other consequences, and then things that are more non-sexual nature would be covered by the other offenses.
Yeah, I think the thinking is if you have somebody's putting their penis in somebody's vagina and they can't prove it's for sexual arousal, maybe somebody does it because, as we know, sexual assaults are crimes of violence, right? They're not necessarily crimes of sexual impulse.
Well, if that were the facts of the case, I think it would still be up to the fact finder to decide what the intent would be with something that clear cut of a case for vaginal penetration. So that was our thinking.
And with the intent and purpose, if you're going to change that, then you would also change the sex offender registration. Because now the sex offender registration is triggered by sexual acts, sexual contact with the minor, certain provisions, etc.
Sure.
So you're changing the definition of sexual act, sexual contact.
Yes, we'd have to look at that because it is a very broad in that chapter, Title 30, the sexual and sex offender registration requirements do hinge on that a bit. Yeah.
So I guess my question is, what's the benefit of the change? Benefit.
It's more narrowly tailored to a sexual offense.
To a sexual offense.
And it is in keeping, again, looking at what other jurisdictions have done across the country, it is more in keeping with that. It's not as broad.
Okay,
that was our thinking, was just to make it more clearly sexual, and then have the other offenses, things that are abuse, humiliate, harass, have that be assault or offensive contact, and just make it clearer and worthy of the registration and the higher penalty as well.
So I guess the way that it is now, as you know, there's certain acts that are just, as you say, they're just obviously sexual, like oral sex, vaginal sex, anal sex. But it sounds like even though those, even from what you're saying, are just kind of, like everybody knows those are sexual in nature, you're still going to add the requirement that the government prove that that act actually is for a sexual purpose and to arouse.
So
what's the reason to do that? Because that's the other thing you do.
That's also with the current statute.
Oral sex, vaginal sex, anal sex.
Oh, I see
sex.
What you're saying.
No,
or for A and B.
Yeah.
Well, let me correct one thing, which is the phrase with intent does not mean purpose, right?
But it's still having to prove that there's something going on in the mind of this person doing it for arousal or gratification, as I say.
Or degrade.
Right. That is the current statute also, right?
Degrade is one of them, right.
Yeah. So there is a requirement right now for the government to prove one of the purposes.
Not for penetration and oral sex.
Right. We added that because we wanted to be consistent and also to clarify there is some case law. I have to look back, but I'm sure you're to sexual act, sexual contact, what is a lesser included offense of the other? And so we thought by having the same intent in all the subsections of sexual act, there wouldn't be an issue about, they couldn't prove the intent under this subsection when they look at sexual contact. And there's a case that gets into that, it's in Re EH, where the court looks at the with intent requirement in the sexual contact definition, and I believe uses that to hint or suggest in dicta that like second and fourth degree would not be a lesser included of first or third degree.
We agree with that.
So we thought by adding in the intent in all the subsections for sexual act, it would just eliminate that issue, and you'd have a clear lesser included without getting into an elements analysis. That's why we added that to subsection B, was to make that relationship clearer and to remove that as an issue.
That isn't really an issue for us. I mean, we don't consider going from a sexual act with no intent to a sexual contact to be lesser included, because the context. So, if we have any question about whether there was penetration, we just add the first and the third degree. So that's an easy fix for us.
Mm-hmm.
Just wondering, because that's
you bet.
That's a makes a very significant change. And
sure, and a couple other points just to kind of note, which is, you know, again, just sequentially, right, we're going through revisions for this, and then, you know, you asked about the sex offense registry implications. You know, what we've kind of said along the way is that any of these changes that have, you know, particularly for definitions, right, implications for other Title 22, non-Title 22 provisions, we don't intend this to apply outside of any of the revised offenses, right? We will see how far we get, right? You know, in addressing, for instance, updating to say this applies for the sex offense registration. Or, you know, again, kind of depending on how far we get, what conforming amendments are then required or not required. Dave's often mentioned that, you know, there will need to be, to the extent there are provisions that we don't get to, perhaps sex offense registry requirements, you know, we're going to need to make sure that those still line up and still have, you know, they're viable, right? So if even a part of an offense, we have recommendations to reform a part of it, the other part remains kind of unrevised, we need to make sure that the current Title 22 peripheral provisions that might define terms in that unrevised portion, that might provide penalties for that unrevised portion, etc., remain in law. And so, you know, again, with the overall goal of saying that we don't want unintended consequences, right, for the revision. So it, you know, some of these, like the general part, we, you know, there's a lot in the general part in terms of culpable mental states, causation, you know, a lot of basic mechanics. Those don't apply outside of the scope of the, you know, revised work.
You know, I agree with that, but sex offender registration may be of a different ilk, because unless the registration statutes align with the elements of the offense, you've got something standing out there with no way to link the two.
You bet.
It effectively, I haven't thought about it perfectly, yeah, because Sharon mentioned, but you might effectively do away with sex offender registration, because the argument would then be the elements of the offense as defined in the registration were not found by the jury.
That's, I mean, right.
They were a different set of elements.
Right.
So I think you almost have to make conforming amendments that one.
Yeah,
you wouldn't be getting rid of sex offender registration,
right?
Like, it would still exist. And acknowledging that there might be some effect doesn't mean not to make the reforms in the code. Maybe you get to it. Maybe it's beyond your mandate, and it's just something that the council has to take up or not.
Yeah,
I didn't mean to say that that's a reason not to change the sex offense elements. I'm saying that's an argument for if you do that, that's one way we have to make the conforming
amendments. Right. And I think that that's right, and like that's a good example of something. For instance, you know, there are other places too where, you know, definitions of crime of violence, right? You know, definitions which elsewhere presuppose under current law kind of, you know, an enumerated list of offenses, right, or underlying predicates that, if we're changing over here, need to then be realigned, right? The extent and when and how to do that, I think, is kind of a more of a back-end issue. First, let's figure out, you know, what the changes are to the predicate offenses. Then we'll come back and kind of look at that. But it is absolutely, you know, an outstanding issue that we want to, like, not lose sight of. One other thing I'd kind of mention is, to the extent there's concern that the scope of what constitutes a sexual act under the B version is substantively shrunk, right? You know, that it's covering less conduct. you know, the one point, one way to focus on that and address that is, again, kind of what is meant by this phrase, and particularly the adverb sexually, right here, which, you know, is debated. Different jurisdictions have approached this differently. Is it inherently, right, sexual, right, to do certain, you know, this type of conduct? Are there some situations where it isn't sexual, but those were never kind of, you know, intended anyway? This is, I think Rachel, you know, might jump in here too, but, you know, again, this, for consistency with the sexual contact definition and for the lower grade offenses throughout, we've been trying to, like, align things so that you have kind of clear lesser includeds. You know, I don't think we expected this to limit the scope of conduct, right? Correct? Yeah, I mean, that is going to be, and so, yes, you know, this might be a point, too, where a statutory change back to something closer to the current statute, or a commentary entry clarifying the intended meaning of this as to include certain conduct might be possible remedies, both of those.
Is the concern with intent or with degrade? I mean, there's other words. I mean, we have a lot of examples where there are a lot of options given, and it's basically saying the same thing over and over and over. And so part of cleaning it up is to say, this word isn't really that different from this.
Well,
and then we're sort of struggling. So I'm asking whether abuse...
What's added is that for crimes, and I wasn't involved in when the statute was obviously written, but there are certain crimes that are just by, you know, kind of erase ipsilaborative, just like by their act, sexual is kind of a wrong word, given that, you know, again, we know that these are crimes of violence, but, you know, vaginal, anal penetration, oral contact, these are not things that parents do. So things that parents can do when they clean a poopy diaper, sticking the fingers in there, you know, external contact, and intent is added, you know, but to add that in addition to this stranger came up, threw the person to the ground, inserted his penis into her vagina, that on top of that, like, and let's say it happens in a second, the victim is blind, the victim can't hear, we have a case where two defendants kidnapped a woman and put, you know, something over her head so she couldn't see anything, nothing is said, she's vaginally raped, but then, like, to say we have to also prove they did this to sexually gratify themselves.
Do you think that would be difficult? I mean, like, do you think
I have no idea. Like, I can only guess from this incredibly violent act that, like, that's, we call it sexual because it involves sex. I guess that's...
Well, but, I mean, it's almost hard to imagine a situation where something like that happened where the person wouldn't have an intent to...
So why add that? Why then have another element? I mean, that's exactly was the thinking, I assume, when the definition of sexual act was drafted and contrasting it with... I mean, the way that it's drafted now, I think it's so simple.
Right.
It's like there's certain things parents can do. We don't want to criminalize what parents do when they clean poopy diapers. So we add this intent, this broad intent.
Right.
Not everybody does it to sexual arouse. We have serial butt grabbers who come up. I don't think they get aroused. I think they do it to harass people, to humiliate. You know, Michael Hilliard, he has 32 of these. He just goes up to strange women, slaps them in the butt, and walks away. And, you know, if a parent did that, obviously, but we have to prove the intent. But just to prove a sexual intent for that, like, he probably just intends to embarrass, you know, abuse them. I mean, these are two separate issues we're talking about. One is whether to put an intent element in things that are sexual. I mean, you were saying these are, like, sexual things, so why add an intent? And then the other is why to narrow the intent when what had... if you have something that works, like, why are we trying to fix that? And, you know, again, there's a lot of issues in here for us, like a major overhaul, and kind of focusing on that is just a preliminary.
Sure.
That's just the top of the surface of a change. And, you know, again, my question is, there was a lot of thought going into the drafting originally that seems to work well. What? Why doesn't it work? Why is that something that's going to have such a big change? Why are we doing that?
Right. And what would your proposed solution then be?
Leave it the way it is. That's my proposed solution. I don't see what the problem is. I mean, this. I assume this is not, just trying to change things for change. The lesser included offense, that has not been a problem.
But it's not a problem for the government because the government can indict the lesser included offense. But the defense can't ask for the lesser included offense if they don't match up, and the defense can't indict the lesser included offense.
Oh, well, I mean, the defense could agree to we've had that. The defense agrees it's a lesser included offense. We don't object to it. There's only been one or two situations I know, like this Peter Taylor had. The defense wanted it. And we said, and Judge Richter said, you know, if the defense wants it, fine. So that's fine. It's really, we don't want to make an appellate issue. So,
but I don't think that every judge would allow a lesser included that is not, in fact, under the law, a lesser included offense to go to the jury.
I'd be interested to know the situations where that has happened. And I mean, having prosecuted these cases since 2000, I keep track of these. I you know, to make this overhaul because maybe there was one judge one time with PDS asked for, I'd be interested to see those. I don't know of them. For us, it's an appellate issue. We're really just trying to preserve the record. And if the defense wants it because they believe it is, I would just, you know, I would instruct my AUSAs to say, have defense counsel on the record say we are waiving any appellate right that we have, that this is not technically a lesser included because it adds this other definite, this other element of intent. And that's how that's resolved. It isn't a problem. I mean, that's...
So you would have to give that instruction? Because it isn't actually the law that it's a lesser included? So you either agree
or... It would be our position that because it has another element, it's not... I mean, sometimes we want the lesser included, you know, like if the child doesn't know whether there was penetration but no touch, sometimes we would want it too, but if we haven't indicted on that, or sometimes they say, like, instead of touching the genitalia, no, it was on the inner thigh, right? I don't know of a situation where the defense has asked for it, and we wouldn't object. Again, we would just ask the defense to waive that issue.
Just sort of a hard fact to assess how much has been asked. If you know it's not a, you know, it's not a lesser included, it's not clear why you would ask.
I'm not sure you guys think it is. I mean, I've heard of the defense saying that it's lesser included, and as I say, I know this one case with Peter and Judge Richter. He agreed, and I mean, I felt nervous about it, but I'm not, you know, if the defense wanted it and the judge, well, that's fine.
There was another way you could go about it. Right? Blockberger only applies when the legislation hasn't spoken as to whatever the elements is, as to what a lesser offense is.
Well, that's the purpose of double jeopardy.
So you're saying
for lesser. And there may be other statutory means of ensuring that the defendant would have a right to a lesser included instruction, even if the elements don't match up. But yeah, Blockberger typically applies to whether they can be punished for both under the double jeopardy clause.
But I think this is the issue, right? Like, in other words, like, appreciate your kind of, you know, raising this change. If you're saying it is, at least in some cases, would pose a difficult task, you know, to prove that this type of behavior was sexual, right, or done with sexual intent, I think our intent was kind of focused on consistency with the sexual contact definition and the lesser included issue. So, you know, we could, again, kind of break this back out and maybe find a different way to address the concerns about, you know, a lesser included issue, since, you know, I hear you kind of saying that's, you don't have a problem with that, but that it's just like, if you can clarify that by statute in another way, but leave the kind of definition the way it is now, sounds like you'd be amenable to that. Is that fair?
I would have to see it. I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying it hasn't been an issue, and...
But this is Paul. It sounds like it hasn't been an issue because of the wise discretion of the prosecutor's office, but we can't always count on that, so I'm not sure what the concern is about making it part of the statute. And also with regard to the other issue, I still haven't heard of a scenario where we would need the law in the way that is proposed. So all of the situations that have been mentioned so far, it sounds like they would be covered either by the, if not the sexual gratification, by the intent to degrade. So if we're trying to streamline and make our code more consistent and less duplicative, again, I'm not sure that I see the need for the change that's suggested.
Yeah, well, so maybe let's focus on the second part, right? Which is again, about the. So I have up on the screen now the current and Paul, this is 22.3001 8, the current DC code definition for sexual act. Just kind of compare that string of verbs. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think my understanding was the second part of your concern was about the change from this string of abuse, humiliate, harass, degrade, or arouse, or gratify the sexual desire of any person to the way it's phrased in the revised code of intent to sexually degrade, arouse, or gratify any person.
Well, I assume sexually also modifies degrade, right? So all of these
That's
are
right.
for a sexual purpose. So again, I think if you look at the literature, these are not necessarily crimes of sexual gratification. These are deranged people that want to want to inflict violence. So it says sexually degrade. I'm not really sure what degrade means anyway, but sexually degrade, all of it is for sexual purpose. And I'm telling you, there could be people that, how do you prove that? I gave you some examples. You could prove it by, this is what we ask for the sexual contact, this is what we ask the victims, including the kids. What was the breathing? What did they say? What did their hands?
Right, but that's because you're focusing on arouse and gratify. Degrade is there.
It's sexually degrade. It's a sexually degrade.
But how is it not sexually degrade if there's penetration?
Well, then why do you need it? That's exactly
well,
right.
But there's been an explanation for why it's needed.
What was that?
There was the explanation about the lesser included, at a minimum.
And that it's a sexual offense. It should be, there should be a sexual intent to make it, to have the severity of that sexual contact. But in the extreme cases are cases of penetration, and it's hard to see how that is not sexually degrading at a minimum.
Yeah, again, so I don't know. It adds another element that we cannot always prove that it's for... I think we're just going... I think I've made my point that to also prove that there's sexual arousal when most violent rapists are not... They don't ejaculate... They don't breathe hard, they throw somebody on the ground, they spread their legs apart, they thrust the penis, and they leave.
I think we get the point, which is, I mean, you keep focusing on arousal, get it, you have trouble proving arousal, but you haven't tackled degrade, but I think you're right, we do, you've made your point.
One question, I now am focused on, which is what you were trying to do, to take a look at the current language, which you have highlighted, and if you could just highlight the language on the left again.
Yeah.
And you're right, you would start that highlight, because at first I thought you had started too soon, but it is sexually modifies degrade. Okay, over here we have, to the extent that we are, and this is Renata speaking now, we are trying to clean up and clarify and make more concise. I get that. And it seems that there's a view then that abusing and humiliating and harassing are all sort of a subset of degradation, right? So that there's a view that, okay, well, we can eliminate those words. But if you did that on the right, so you have an intent to degrade or arouse or gratify the sexual desire of any person, it's not clear to me then that a translation of that would include the phrase sexually degrade. What is sexual degradation versus degradation?
I guess I'm just not clear on whether
sexually degrade is from the perspective of the complainant or from the perspective of the perpetrator, because it sounds like...
Oh, well, it's obviously like perpetrator with the intent, right? It's the defendant with the intent to do that. And
I don't think we also represented the intent to, I don't think, in the commentary, that we exactly had translated the language in the current law on the right to the left. I do think we made a point that we were specifying sexually degrade, because it's unclear, arguably, or it's clear that sexually is not doing anything to degrade in the current law. So I don't think we intended to say they were exact translations. Again, our idea was just abuse, humiliate, harass. It's very broad and could bring in a lot of contact that isn't sexual in nature. You have these higher penalties. You have the registration requirement. So narrow it, like many jurisdictions have done, to the sexually degrade, arouse, or gratify. But I want to just be clear. I don't think we did not intend to say that what's on the left is a translation of what's on the right. Okay.
So it is significantly different now in my mind, because I don't know. It seems to me that the current law provides for that broader...
Yes, and we want it to be narrower, because again, it's a sexual offense with much higher penalties. Like if you commit a sexual act, but first degree, third degree, you're looking at 20 and 5 or 20 and 10 years. Abuse, humiliation, and harass could also bring in a lot of just a lot of contact that is not sexual in nature, that does not warrant the same penalty and registration offense. Collateral consequences as sexually degrade, arouse, or gratify. And it sounds like in the vast majority of situations, it's no matter what the language is there in the statute, it's going to get to the fact finder. And in a case where you did have someone thrown to the ground, legs spread apart, and penetrated, it's going to be, I think, it'd be hard to say that's not an intent to sexually degrade, arouse, or gratify.
I guess I'd be interested to know, you said that there's a lot of situations that are covered by that language. This broad language, abuse, humiliate, da da da.
Like the guy in Metro who comes up and just like smacks an individual on the bottom.
Who doesn't have penetration.
Right, that's a misdemeanor. Right, that's a misdemeanor.
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought we're looking at penetration. So the question would be...
Well, it's the same intent, right? So, I mean, I would be interested if in fact, not what one believes, but if in fact, in D.C., there has been this... You know, the broad spectrum of cases that have been brought as felonies that only meet the definition of humiliated harass that, in your committee's belief, do not justify it. Because I don't know them. I would be interested to know actual
cases. We might
cases.
Not be privy to that data. That might be something USAO has that we don't have. But again, the point that Professor Butler raised is. It is still on the books as the law, and so it can change depending on prosecutors, and that is something we're also trying to fix, to make it more consistent, so it doesn't depend so much on who might be prosecuting or what a judge says. That's part of it too, and the fact that some of these issues you've pointed out aren't actually issues maybe in practice speaks highly of your office. It doesn't change the fact that the law is what the law is, and so that's kind of been our guiding principle too, is making it clear and consistent so anybody can look at this and know what they're getting into or what consequences they face or what has to be proven without getting into the nitty-gritty of the day in and day out of practice.
Yeah. I do think, and I assume you would agree, that the actual practice is some evidence of whether a particular provision works well, because the provisions were designed when they were drafted after a lot of thought and consideration on every single word. So to make a dramatic change, I would think that there needs to be kind of more than just thinking that it's a problem, but it's actually a problem. So again, this was just kind of one example from the very, very beginning of the definition. And I appreciate the discussion about it. So thank
Great.
You.
Good. Well, let's, unless there's any other thing, I think, you know, right, comment like this, it's helpful to kind of, again, many changes, reflect on the impact and importance of all of them. So yeah, look forward to maybe, seeing more kind of discussion of that, and that lets everybody then kind of you know, review their own kind of arguments and considerations. Are there other matters regarding the comments in particular that were made on sex offenses that were submitted by OAG or the Public Defender Service that anybody would like to discuss?
Can I ask, Dave, what, I'm on page 4, there are a couple of comments I didn't understand. Actually, let's start on page 3, with the first comment you made with respect to sexual assault. I said all I wrote in my margin notes was, don't understand proposal.
Okay, let me just review it for a second.
Sure, and I've got it up on the screen for those who, I believe, Laura, is this the what you're looking at on your hard
right.
copy too?
Okay. Right, the willful, the sort of make it similar to willful blindness. I didn't.
Ah, yeah, the willful blindness.
Oh, this is the intoxication stuff.
Yeah, so we had some discussion with OAG about this, and I think, you know, there was some sense that this may be addressed, you know, kind of through piecing together aspects of the general part. And again, our current willful blindness provision, you know, we're updating that too. So, but the hypothetical, right, I'll read it for Paul too. While understanding why the commission chose to use the mental state of knowingly in these offenses, a person should not be able to decide to rape or otherwise sexually abuse someone, consume massive amounts of alcohol to get up the nerve to do it, consummate the rape, and then be able to argue, whether true or not, that at the time of the rape, he lacked the mental state necessary to be convicted of the offense, right? So the hypothetical you know, has multiple parts, but it kind of starts with
having the intent.
A person, yeah, deciding to do this, right? Deciding to commit a rape, a sexual abuse. Then, again, taking some drug, alcohol, whatever. Then committing the acts, and then arguing again, truthfully or not, that intoxication
defeated the mental state,
and therefore that element is not met. Maybe again, there's a lower level, the kind of catch-all, more non-consensual sexual abuse, right? But regardless, you know, at least for the upper gradations, that might defeat knowledge. And you know, in partly, you know, our initial discussion with Dave on this was, you know, I hit a few different points. I'll defer to Michael on this, but once that intent is formed, and then to try to escape liability for the act, this would kind of fall under our general provisions, willful blindness provision, where knowledge is otherwise required if the person was reckless and, you know, did, you know, intoxicated themselves, you know, to avoid liability, then only a recklessness is required, right?
Yeah.
So as the interlocking of that example might help here. I just say that on a base level,
like, we agree that there should be liability in that situation, and, you know, we'll clarify that there is, and that, you know, people can't avoid criminal liability. You know, these are
there has to be proof of that hypothetical.
Sorry, yeah. What's that?
Right, in this hypothetical.
Exactly. They're called like culpability and causing situations where someone may go out of their way at an earlier point in time to construct a scenario that would somehow preclude them from possessing certain elements at a later point in time. And, you know, base level, like, we agree that there should be liability and we'll clarify it. But, you know, how we get there, you know, I think ultimately it's a combination of the willful blindness and then the voluntary intoxication imputation, but that under this, under these circumstances, there would be liability.
Right. So, and that was, that was,
and
the
it was
concern.
Fine, yeah. Yeah. The clarification is where I was going.
Okay, I just...
Yeah. Does that help to get
it does,
you?
It does,
yeah, okay.
It does.
Yeah, and so, so right, this is one of those places where, right, how intoxication fits in, how willful blindness fits in, which, you know, it doesn't seem like there's anything special about rape here, right? You know,
it just, it was really the first opportunity to do it, because it's, yeah, it's basically a consideration we have when we move away from general intent, specific intent, kind of stuff, mm-hmm, and intoxication,
right,
in general intent, and we move to knowingly. Mm-hmm. And I understand why, like I said in my memo, why,
sure,
why the commission chooses to use knowingly in a lot of places where I'm going,
yeah,
to put about intoxication,
yep,
as a defense.
Yeah.
And that, and as long as the extreme scenario, yeah, is accounted for,
yeah, yeah,
I'm not arguing against knowingly being,
yeah,
used in the various provisions. This just seemed to be a good example of,
yeah,
when to,
yeah,
bring
it was.
And it's an example we'll, you know, I think maybe even directly kind of incorporate into the commentary is like, mm-hmm, you know, here's an, you know, clear example where it would still putting together the pieces.
This is Paul.
Yes. Yes, Paul.
I'm not sure that the answer is as obvious as some people might think it is. So, but, you know, obviously crimes have a mens rea and an actus reus, and the mens rea, as we've thought about, are carefully considered. And so if the mens rea for a crime like rape is the purpose to do it, or knowing that you're doing it, or understanding that there's a big chance that you're forcing someone to have sex but proceeding anyway, that's a very culpable mind state. So that's what's being punished. And if someone doesn't have that mind state, there's certainly an argument that they're not as culpable. And we could ask, well, does it matter why they don't have the mind state? Yeah, maybe it matters. But again, I don't think that's as obvious as other people might think.
Right. I guess, you know, this is a very fact-sensitive kind of, right, inquiry. Certainly, intoxication certainly is a part of many of these cases. And, again, this kind of, as kind of Dave's hypothetical had postulated, a calculating, you know, use of an intoxicant. That's the situation where I think we feel like the willful blindness provision kicks in. Now, without that, right, you know, the person who's at a party and, you know, right, takes, you know, heavy intoxicants, then, but not with a intent to, you know, commit a criminal act or somehow, you know, insulate themselves from liability, but simply, you know, is very high or very drunk, then we're squarely back in the traditional voluntary intoxication land and how that fits with liability. And right now, as the statutes kind of lay out, right, this is a question of assuming the person is at least reckless, right? Then it's a question of gradation, right? The reckless behavior would at least fall under the non-consensual sexual act. Knowing behavior, and that's the you know, line between the two is where voluntary intoxication might kick in. And so, you know, as long as the person was reckless. Now, again, you can imagine people being intoxicated to the point that they are not even reckless, right, in engaging in this conduct. And that would fall out of both of the gradations in the RCC. So you know, at least in theory.
Well, except the reckless, the imputation, recklessness imputation under our intoxication provision would kick in to impute it, right, because it's but forth, so.
Oh, I mean somebody who was like, you know, right, not subjectively aware at all, right?
Right,
like,
no,
you know.
Right, but you don't need to be, right, so you, the intoxication imputation principle says that if the reason why you don't have that awareness is because you're intoxicated,
right,
then the awareness is imputed.
Right. So that's for the knowledge reckless mind. Well, all I was noting was that there are also obviously hypotheticals where somebody is barely functional and not even subjectively aware, and that would defeated under either of these. Right.
That's right.
Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
I mean, the scenario that kind of teases out the mens rea element is the Regina versus Morgan case, the case from England in which the a senior Air Force officer told his junior officers that his wife was kinky and she would act like she didn't want to have sex and protest, but she really would. And so they go and they basically force her to have sex. She's protesting. And so the question was, well, if they honestly believed what the husband said about his wife and the standard is recklessness, would they be guilty? And you have a sense of how that would come out under our code?
Well, so I view that as kind of a straightforward the mens rea of sex assault question. I mean, the question there is what mens rea is as to the absence of consent, and based upon the information the officers had received, they would seem to lack awareness that consent was lacking. And so, right, recklessness requires awareness of a substantial risk. And so the question that seems to me would be pretty straightforward, that the question, based upon the facts, based upon the information the officers have, did or did they not have an awareness of the risk that consent was lacking?
Yeah. Now, and again, if they did, because of other circumstances in the case, there were indicators that this was a ruse, right? You know, that this was, in fact, then it's totally up to the fact finder, and they might very well find that, you know, that person was reckless. So anyway, so that would be the standard, very fact sensitive, I think, as to like whether you would imply, you know, impute recklessness or not in that case.
The issue Dave raises is closer to our voluntariness provision, right? So, you know, in the sort of classic culpability and causing time framing case Decina, you have someone who has a seizure while driving. And so, and then it leads to someone's death, right? So in that moment, the person's having a seizure, the act is not voluntary, but, you know, had an hour earlier, they knowingly chose not to take their seizure medication, right? Arguably there's a level of culpability sufficient to impute the voluntariness. You know, it depends upon how the width of the lens in which you're viewing the mens rea as happening just at the precise moment of the crash, or whether a decision made earlier would be part of viewing that as present or not. So, if I'm understanding Dave's point correctly, that's the sort of central issue.
But except, isn't, I understood the hypothetical to be a little bit different, right? Which is, well, I could read it, I suppose, but it's premeditated rape, right? It is a decision not to have sex with that person, but to have sex with that person against their will, and then saying, the only way I'm going to have the nerve to do that is to become intoxicated, as opposed to, that person looks hot, I'm going to have sex with him, but I'm actually shy. So the way I'm going to get up the nerve to go approach them is to drink.
Yeah, that's different.
And then, is it?
Yes.
So I don't remember, right? I imagine imputation of knowledge for deliberate ignorance is a little bit different, right? It's not just that I am, that because I have become intoxicated and I am not fully capable of perceiving the circumstance, which is her reluctance or whatever, I just want to make sure we're not getting there for, like, every social drinking situation.
No.
Why? Because I don't remember the rest of how willful blindness works.
Right.
That it is, that there is some proof that in the beginning what I wanted to do was was unlawful, as opposed to, right?
Right. She could have said willful, yes. Our willful blindness provision has two provisions. Knowledge is imputed under two conditions. One, the person was at least reckless as to the risk, right? So the person at least had some subjective awareness. And two, the reason why the person deliberately avoided or failed to confirm the existence of that circumstance was in order to preserve a defense to liability.
Okay, but thank you.
So,
okay, yeah. I just couldn't. Thank
yeah.
you.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Other thoughts or questions on sex offenses? Otherwise, it's 11 o'clock. Why don't we move on to human trafficking and the comments that we had on human trafficking. If there are any further discussion of those, I think, again, many points raised.
One more question.
Sure.
Can you just talk a little bit more about the rationale for only having the enhancements with respect to the sexual assault and not, for example, to the sexual abuse of a minor or the other provisions there?
Sure. Right. I mean, one point to say up front is that on penalty issues, we haven't addressed, right, like penalties for any of these. And so there will be a further examination of that going forward. But which enhancements were, can you give an example of one that you were questioning or concerned
about?
Obviously
the under 12 kind of one is handled kind of in the words of the statute, but for example, the significant relationship, you know, that's a frequent one that's used, you know, a father or something like that. And that's a pretty frequent enhancement that's used. It seems like it only apply if there's some sort of force use, but wouldn't apply in a non-forced sexual use of a minor situation. And I just wanted to
comment. Our thinking was, depending on which enhancement you're talking about, to take the position of trust, I guess it'd be what, 4C we're talking about specifically? But just in general, it's duplicative with the elements of the offense, depending on which offense. Like under sexual abuse of a minor, under current law, and definitely I believe how we've structured it, you have to prove for sexual abuse of a minor for, I believe it's grades third degree and sixth degree, you have to prove there's a significant relationship. So to have a penalty enhancement applied to that that's duplicative, I think it's an open question if the Court of Appeals would even let that happen, given some of the ADW case law. And then in the other ones, it would also be potentially duplicative. This an adult statute, depending on the relationship there, if that falls underneath significant relationship or position of trust or authority, that is duplicative. Similarly with sexually suggestive conduct with a minor. So in that particular instance, it's more just it's duplicative of the elements of the offense or the factual elements of the offense.
And particularly for like first degree sexual abuse of minors, second degree sexual abuse of minors, so probably the ones that would have the more serious penalties, I'm assuming. Sadly, we have a lot of kind of father-daughter cases or something like that where that enhancement kind of clarifies that that particular behavior might be a bit more heinous than other relationships that might exist, and that's a kind of frequent aggravator that I have used and I presume others in our section have used that I think kind of serves to adequately represent the different nature of that conduct that wouldn't be represented necessarily with first-degree sexual abuse of a minor otherwise. And that was kind of what I was thinking. That in particular enhancement jumped out to me because that's a frequent one that's used.
I'm sorry. So just to kind of back up a little bit. So your concern is to have enhancement for age and also the relationship to have both on top of that. Am I hearing
that? That was just one of them. I mean, I noticed kind of that's my example that's popping out, but I noticed that the enhancements aren't, you know, broadly applied to the statute as they were in the old statute. And the one that kind of struck me immediately was, like I said, sadly, this is a frequent one that we have to use, like in a father-daughter incest type of case, that there's no way to fully capture the particular heinousness of that offense within the proposed new statute in a way that could have captured the old statute.
I think it's also difficult to say without having numbers attached to things, because maybe under whatever sentencing scheme we come up with, there would be some kind of, who knows how first-degree sexual abuse of a minor would be graded in terms of years. That's also part of the discussion, I think. But again, we...
the 13 or something, you don't get first degree, then you get to the second degree.
Second degree, yeah. I think again, we just were looking at this and thought that the age is the most significant bad factor.
In general, one thing that we found kind of across the board, right? Not sex offense is one thing, right? Like, we've got sex offense aggravators in many, right, many places in Title 22, outside of Title 22. Things that are applicable to sex offenses, they overlap. In some places, they contradict. So, you know, we're trying our best to clean this area up and be very interested to know, too, like, and again, in part, this is particularly, you know, comes to when there are numbers attached, but to what extent... you know, in practice experience, that has raised any of these aggravators have raised the sentence above the otherwise kind of authorized statutory.
And I have a few examples offhand. I just had a case. It was a father-daughter case, a 13-year-old girl, so she would not have been eligible for the under 12 enhancement. He had not enforced sex with her twice, enforced sex one time, but got her pregnant as a result, and she had the child. Which she only found out about when she was about 36 weeks pregnant. Mm-hmm. So the range, he had no criminal history, and his range would have been 7.5 to 15 years. But he pled to 17 years, which included the aggravator, because we felt that that didn't fully capture the seriousness. I think that was a relatively generous plea, a 17-year plea. So that required the use of the enhancement. Likewise, I had a father-daughter case where she estimated he had sex with her approximately 200 or 300 times when she was... between the ages of, I think, 14 and 16.
Sure.
And his ultimate sentence was 21 and a half years,
sure.
which also would have been above his guideline range of 15 years.
Right.
And so we required a plea to the aggravating circumstances in order to have that those options available.
Right. Well, and sorry, just to clarify. So in the first case, there was forced sex?
He did not plead guilty to that count. I mean, he made admissions that he engaged in non-forced sex with her.
Right.
So we offer a plea to first-degree child, not first-degree sexual abuse.
You bet.
But
yeah, and you know, right.
There were instances where I think would not have been captured, the seriousness of the offense would not have been captured without the enhancements that applied.
Sure, and welcome, information on this, other instances. You know, we hopefully will be getting more court data before too long. Based on our prior pull of court data and also looking at some of the data from the Sentencing Commission, across the board, this is a very big picture, there were very few places where any any use, particularly of like the repeat offender enhancements, anything other than while armed, any other offense enhancements, one were used fairly rarely. Certainly, given criminal history scores of many defendants and their eligibility for repeat offender enhancements, but also, you know, the number of times that the statutory maximum that resulted. The statutory maximum that was exceeded by virtue of the enhancement, we were talking maybe one a year. It was a pretty surprising finding. Now, again, we need to like check that right when we come back to this. And there are definitely, you know, understand that, you know, how you approach, you know, plea negotiations in particular, where there might be, you know, especially multiple charges, right? Multiple instances. You're saying, you know, a person who, you know, dozens, hundreds of times, right? You know, kind of by any the number of counts, right? Is just, you know. This is a life, you know. The person's looking at life depending on how you carve it up, right? For any one particular count, focusing just on that, that's where when we kind of look at the effect of these aggravators, it's kind of most interesting. And what we've kind of seen, again, examples of the contrary, definitely welcome, is that it rarely, and maybe that's a function of the guidelines, right? How all that intersects. Often these cases involve other, charges, right? Are they run consecutive? Are they run concurrent, right? Like all sorts of dynamics, and we appreciate that. But again, kind of the stats that we've seen are that the aggravators haven't been used in practice to raise the statutory maximum beyond what was there. So counterexamples, welcome, right? And again, we'll be checking with this updated data set and whenever we get that to make sure that that's, and again, we're also looking not just at sex abuse aggravators there. That was, senior minor enhancements, broadly to crimes of violence, or for seniors, it's not even crimes of violence, right? It's a specialized list that's kind of like the crime of violence definition, but not quite. That's something we want to be thinking about across the board.
I think your point about plea negotiations as well, it has to inform your view of the data that you get back, mm-hmm. because those enhancements do become plea fodder mm-hmm. in a lot of instances. And so it makes sense that the data would weigh out the way it does, mm-hmm. even if the initial charging decision was different mm-hmm. and included the aggravating circumstances. Mm-hmm. Those are just things that end up on the table when we're negotiating.
Yeah, yeah. Good. So that was the last point on sex abuse. Anything else, or I suggest we move on to human trafficking and any comments there? Comments on the comments. We had kind of some fairly extensive discussion on some of these issues before the prior meeting. I guess even in December. So I don't know if there was, any follow up at this point. Questions?
Just sort of a general question.
Yeah.
The decision to take fraud out of the scenario, what sort of informed that, and were there different thoughts about fraud, included in sex trafficking versus labor trafficking? What were the thoughts there?
What, can you be more specific, please?
So in let's see, so we could go to, I guess that's page 22A-1605, trafficking in labor services. The first offense definition, the last section says by means of coercion or debt bondage. The old language used to have means of forged fraud or coercion. So it's changed to coercion or debt bondage. Taking fraud out of the scenario and taking force out of the scenario. I think I understand the force element because you put it, you've got it in other sections.
Broken it out,
yeah. You have forced labor or services, and you have forced commercial sex, so I kind of get that. But for the trafficking in labor or services where you have that more general statute, what was the thinking behind taking fraud out? In the sex cases, I think I get it because that's rarely ever used as the reason for adult sex trafficking victims. They were defrauded into the act. But for labor, there tends to be more instances for the few cases that we have of people being told one thing, made representations made to them about what their work scenario would be, and then being either brought over or brought into the work scenario and then receiving something totally different. For instance, being told they're going to receive $800 for doing a debt on somebody's house, and then they, they're not paid anything and threatened with ICE, or they are paid a lot less. And that's, I think that would be a fraud scenario, so, and not necessarily a coercion or a debt bondage scenario.
Right. So, I mean, a lot of instances of human trafficking involve some kind of fraud to initially lure a person, maybe with, like, a false promise of a lucrative job, which then leads to some sort of other sort of coercive work situation where there's a threat of force, there's a threat of deportation or something like that, which would still be covered by the trafficking provisions. But our thing was that when it's purely fraud, so it's, yeah, repaint my deck and I'll pay you $1,000, and then, oops, I'm not going to pay you the full $1,000, it turns out, after I've got my deck painted, we really consider that as more, that's just sort of basically fraudulent theft of services. It's really more purely of a property crime and is very different than forcing someone through these other coercive means to perform labor. So that was the thought process.
Yeah, one helpful thing would be, theft of services or fraud, mm-hmm. right? How to distinguish these cases otherwise, right? Such that we could say, again, anytime a person in a work dispute argues that they were, that the other person kind of knowingly lied to them, right, about, a substantial aspect of their employment contract, that wasn't human trafficking, that is property offense land, theft fraud versus human trafficking. How do we distinguish those? Because right now, by categorically, put it this way too, the coercion definition, both, kind of what we, kind of retained, has this catch-all, right? Which kind of matches the current definition of coercion, has this other similar, any scheme, plan, or pattern intended to cause a person to believe that if they didn't perform, would suffer serious, physical harm or restraint, or...
Right. Serious harm isn't... Right.
Yeah, serious harm, and then serious harm is defined as, like, basically anything that, right, would compel a person. So we tried to make that a little clearer, kind of unpack those definitions, right? Part of what we wanted to do was clarify that these kinds of per se forms of coercion, we want to be really careful and cautious about what gets you in there. And the thought was most of what constitutes, like, again, fraud in a, anytime you knowingly hire somebody with a lie about their benefits, anything of the sort, we don't want to automatically convert that to trafficking, but it still could, maybe depending on the scenario, come in under the catch-all, right?
The examples that were given was a threat of deportation or of calling ICE. That gets you into coercion. The second one you gave is it's theft of services, right? The, like, if you take this job, you will get to prosecute sex crimes and you'll get to, go visit, go have lunch at the White House every week. Well, if you agreed to that, it wouldn't be trafficking, but it might be, right? If you're like, that's why I'm taking the job, then that, if that was a valuable benefit, then that might be theft of services, but it doesn't make you trafficking. But if it is, when you show up and they're like, and you better work, or here's what's going to happen, then you're moving into this. So we did cover, and I'm still fighting that fight over how labor is going to be sort of valued. I'm going to win that fight. But it is covered, but I think you added another little thing, and that is in here, I think.
So I think how it ends up happening in practice, like I said, the sort of overt threat of I'm going to call ICE or whatever. Mm-hmm. Sometimes in practice how it works out is, okay, well, go to the court with your property or your fraudulent theft claim,
but
knowing implicitly that the person doesn't have papers, that the person may be here illegally, so that coercion is not something that's as easily proven as what's laid out here, right? And so fraud, I think the federal statute has fraud as sort of the type of catch-all that you all are trying to do with the coercion section. Does that make sense?
Mm. One of the points also threats it includes also not just explicit, or you know, I'm going to do it. It implies some implicit threats based on the words. So, you know, we can read between the lines, at least in certain cases, and say, we understand what this person was really threatening to do. So it may have a little bit of a broader reach than it sort of appears on its face.
Do we have harm defined anywhere?
No.
So it says cause any harm.
Yep. Yep.
Maybe we should say something more like cause any occurrence that is sufficiently undesirable. Because I'm not sure that it's clear what we mean by harm.
The OAG has raised the point before, at least, forgive me, I don't think it was here. I think it was somewhere else about, like, you know, questioning, does this mean, you know, physical harm? Could this be financial? Right, like, just to, like, clarify that. And in general, because harm gets used in many places, and we don't have a specialized definition for it, but in places where it might seem... you know, either because of the weight of prior practice or law, or something, you know, we've in the commentary kind of addressed that, like, to clarify, this would include, you know, financial harms, etc. So, so no, we don't have a definition. We do, I think, mean it here just in an ordinary, which is to say, a very general sense, right? Like, you know. And I think we in the commentary tried to make this clear, but right, you know, it could end up being a financial harm. It could end up being a, you know, reputational harm. It could be, the, you know, any of these kinds of things. So unless we otherwise clarify it, the dictionary definition of, you know, and ordinary definition, it isn't limited in any particular way.
But it isn't that a harm occurred. Maybe this is part of the point. It's that the labor is being compelled. It's like why you have to stay on the job. Not, I showed up, I was promised a breakfast buffet every day, and because that would actually get me to sign on to a job, and it's not there, I'd be like, screw this, I'm leaving. And if I get to walk out the door, then I don't think that's trafficking. It may be something else, because I put it an hour before I was told breakfast was going to be served, and there was no breakfast. Or I put in a whole day. But it isn't trafficking. It isn't trafficking. It's theft of my labor. But and you better come back and continue, and you need to keep working because I can't walk off the job. That strikes me, that's the trafficking. If I walk out, if I stop, here's what happens. So because then the harm is just I lost a day's work.
Or a week.
I agree with you. We got it covered, and you have no. You are.
I lost 3 weeks.
Yes.
There's no reason.
Is the recorder getting this?
There's no reason you would know, but one of the earlier recommendations from the Public Defender Service,
was brilliant.
Which some would say was brilliant. Remains to be seen how it will be handled. Was to also change kind of how. Again, we kind of measure the damages for this, right? And to particularly the PDS recommendation, the gist of it, I will try to summarize, was to basically say that despite a low market value, for instance, of a certain labor, you know, manual labor or gardener or something, right, that there would be greater consequences because even though the whatever, again, commercial value was $7 an hour a day, $56. Instead, and compared that to the harm of a, you know, big law firm billing $1,000. You know, like, we don't want to peg penalties purely to the financial value of the stolen services, right, or the defrauded services, but we want to adjust that at least at the bottom end. To reflect that for particularly, you know, low-income individuals,
the proposal that you backed into without realizing it is to value time. That an hour of my time, however much I make, is the same as the hour of the people that are going to come in and clean this room after we leave. That if you steal a week of my time, it's the same. However, we're going to punish it. It doesn't matter what my per hour salary is versus the other. But in any case, it's covered
that's,
as a.
Yeah.
However you value it,
yeah, that's right.
that as a crime is covered. It's and so it's not that there isn't any and aggregated, right? So it's not, you know, it's not the bang for the buck that you get with the sort of trafficking of, like, it's really serious if you do a lot, one person for a long period of time or multiple people, you get that punishment. But the trafficking or the forced labor services is forcing the labor, which is you don't get to leave. So I feel like some of the things you're capturing is not that the fraud happened in the first place. It might be how you got the person to show up. But the forced labor services or the trafficking in that, if you're the recruiter, is knowing once the person figures out that was a lie, there's no breakfast buffet, they're still not allowed to leave. There's still something that it's like, I'm calling ICE, fine, go to court, tell them how I'm terrible, but get back to work with me. Something that is compelled, that is a harm, that is enough to like be like, shit, I need to stay on this job.
And Richard, if people are, I know that you're saying you mean harm to be broad, but if you go to this Merriam-Webster dictionary, you have
yes.
a table,
yes.
it is defined very specifically as mental or physical damage. So I really want to urge us to think about that a little bit more.
Good. Yeah. I think it's a tricky issue because again, we want a term that is very broad. We don't want to get into the laundry list attempt to like cover financial and reputation, and then we leave something out, right? Like, so like, can we find a term that does that, right? Without going the laundry list route, and or again, in a statutory hard definition, or do you go the, you know, we've definitely done that in commentary, or at least we've tried to, and I think, you know, but in terms of codifying it in a statutory sense.
What about outcome that is sufficiently undesirable?
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, can we start with
an outcome? Okay. Yeah. Exactly. So. Yeah. Maybe we can like just like sidestep it that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe that's a. Yeah. Because I think that is, it's as blank, at least here. There's no sense that like we're trying
to undesirability.
I'm sorry.
It's sufficiently serious in its undesirability. Is that
or
an outcome sufficiently undesirable?
No,
or, you know, I
mean, what's sufficiently? But okay, I mean, whatever. You'll sort it out.
Yeah, I mean, I think wordsmithing that might be, to make sure the language is broad. Definitely an option. All right. It's 11:30. Let me kind of check and see again whether there's anything else on trafficking, or I'm guessing too that failure to arrest in the withdrawal defense have probably less. There were a few comments. They're just smaller provisions. So assuming that, you know, yeah, anything else on trafficking, and then we'll stalking.
Yeah. Not now. I'll
okay. Yeah, and like I just like again kind of reiterate, you know, we've met before with, you know, some of the offices at times, and happy to do that too, to kind of hear more, and again down the road there'll be another chance for, you know, kind of written comments on our. On the revisions, but just orally, yeah.
Did you? I just had a couple questions on stalking.
Yes. So
that in?
You bet. Well, yeah. So trafficking. Anything more there? Otherwise, we will move to stalking. Great. I think go. Yes, stalking.
Two things to write in the very first in the definition or the very first paragraph. When you say that it consists of a combination of the following. What does that mean?
Yeah, I think the word combination is actually unhelpful because it really could be
It really should just be any of the following.
Okay, that's what I wanted.
Yeah, we didn't mean anything else, so
yeah, okay.
It was just
okay, that's
one right. of those efforts to try to be too clear and then actually making it less
yeah.
clear.
Yeah, mm-hmm. any one of the following.
Yeah.
So, and then the other thing is on this 1B, little ooh, A1, ooh. B, capital B, when you use the word individual, what
so
did you mean by that?
It's,
who's that?
It's a little confusing the way that we have it now, and the next draft will aim to be clearer about when we're talking about the defendant and when we're talking about the stalking victim. And so we'll probably use the word complainant.
Well, but what if it's a lawyer? What if it's a boyfriend? Like, why does it have to be the complainant? Like, a lot of times we advise the complainants to not directly reach out to the defendant, but to do it through somebody else. Like,
yeah, the commentary explains that it can be that they can be notified directly or indirectly, and gives examples of being notified through other people.
So we mean to include that indirect. Is that
okay.
what you were? Is
the
that
notice
what you were,
requirement? You mean?
Yeah, and so you so. You can.
So yeah, the it wasn't meant to.
And I just wondered
yeah,
if
limit.
You already have purposefully, like a person commits stalking and that person purposely does this. Doesn't the word purposely already assume that like they know? They're not supposed to, so isn't that?
No. Well, so they have to purposely engage in the pattern of conduct, but they have to, that doesn't necessarily mean that they know that they've been told to stop. So that's why it's the notice requirement's explicitly in there.
So yeah, purposely and knowingly.
Yeah, to our like the purpose, right?
Right. I just wonder with the notice, since it's limited to that, sometimes like the victim doesn't actually notify, but they run away, they start crying. You know, there's other indications that this is not desired activity.
Yeah, so the notice requirement only applies to communication. It doesn't apply to other kinds of activity. So if somebody is engaging in a pattern of conduct, such as committing property crime against the same person over and over, or physically following them, from place to place,
threats.
There is no notice requirement for that at all. It's only with respect to communication. So if somebody is communicating to someone and they start crying, that doesn't necessarily satisfy the notice requirement. The person needs to say, I don't want you contacting me.
So when you say communicate, what if they come up to them? I guess you'd call that physically following? Physically
it could be.
Yeah.
Could,
the word communicating is used in a few of our other offenses, mm-hmm. and I might be able to sort of import the explanation of what communication means into the commentary for stalking to make that more clear.
Can I ask a follow-up question on the commentary? I just couldn't find it, but I thought it was in there. So the situation is the stalking victim doesn't want to speak to the person as in the last time thought. And they send their new boyfriend to tell the old boyfriend, don't bother her. There was a part in the commentary that sort of confused me in that situation, or at least led for what might be inconsistent results. Does the new boyfriend have to say, and she asked me to tell you to leave him alone in order for the provision to kick in? Because I thought, you know, the way you phrase that, if it's just a new boyfriend saying, leave her alone, then that may not trigger the stalking. So how does that actually operate in the situation that you just said?
So it doesn't turn on the language that the boyfriend uses. It really turns on the culpable mental state of the stalker. So if someone, the boyfriend comes to the person and they say, leave her alone, and it's clear to the stalker that she wants to be left alone, then that's one thing. But if it's just, you know, the overbearing parent says, I don't want you dating my daughter anymore, and the person believes, in fact, that the daughter wants to continue having the correspondence, then that would negate the culpable mental state. So it isn't quite as clean as the person having to say, she told me to tell you to stop. It's just, if it's been made clear to you that this person doesn't want contact, whether that's through the boyfriend or through a lawyer or through any other person, then that would be sufficient.
Yeah, we can follow up if there's a particular passage, right? Like this may be
there was a line
the sentence.
Yeah, and I just want to make sure that it's clear.
Sure.
To that.
Yeah, I'm not. Nothing is popping for me that would, but if you want to,
see
it later. Yeah, follow up. Anything else on stalking?
I had one question.
You bet.
Physically foul, is that the... Let me find it. Where is that in the provision?
We did not have a definition for physically following in there, and I think we have a definition for physically monitoring, but we will give some thought to whether we should just add a definition of physically following as well.
Okay. Yeah, this is a tough one, right? Because again, like, we don't want to craft in words.
If it's not an issue,
how it is, right?
It was like just one of the things that I was thinking about, and TDS had a suggestion about it. And so I was trying to think through what you were trying to
do. I mean, it was language you used. We just said.
To bring that over in, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's...
You found words for it.
Yeah.
They were good words.
Well, Patrice found words already, but yeah. Those are satisfactory, right? Like, I don't...
The problem I had with that was what does close proximity mean?
Okay.
Because, when you say to maintain proximity, that's one thing. Close proximity is, if I follow one store behind,
right.
Is that close proximity?
Right.
Is it a half a store? Is it two stores? That's what I had with that modifier.
So yeah.
I think we mean something similar to what we said about proximity in the rioting and public order offenses, which is pulled from that case law about close enough to see or hear what's going on.
And I'm fine with that. It was the word close that I didn't undefine how that actually plays out.
Yeah, and I, again, don't know, besides commentary to flesh out close, I don't know the...
I could make it clear that close doesn't mean near enough to touch the person.
No, I actually like what you just said.
Okay,
And I think...
To point with the other commentary definition was.
Good.
Make it clear what that means.
Okay. Good.
Something like immediate vicinity.
I mean, what I want to do is avoid the situation where he's two stores behind and always follows you down.
Right.
Now, that's not, close proximity.
Got it.
Two stores away.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Good. Other thoughts or questions on stalking, failure to arrest, or the withdrawal defense? I'm opening up more broadly.
Thank you very much.
Check.
A lot of hard work.
No, and really, definitely invite, again, whatever kind of follow up, because I think there's going to be a lot of places where, the drafting does not intended to narrow things in a particular way, or we didn't think that was a significant thing. You might think it is, right? So love to get feedback.
Yeah.
So happy to set up a meeting time, and kind of. Hear that.
Just want to make it clear. We can meet with the commission.
Yeah.
Obviously, we can meet with our partners here at the table as well. And am I correct that now you'll be going back and producing the second draft is how this will work? That will likely happen, mid-March-ish?
Yeah,
and then
maybe late March. We'll see. I'll go with March.
Okay, sometime in March.
Yes,
that works for us. And then we would get approximately 8 weeks for a response. Should we choose to submit written comments?
Yeah, I think that's in the ballpark. I haven't kind of figured out yet, kind of the timeline, but ballpark.
Do you do another draft that incorporates
At that point, I don't know, right? Like, at that point, we're going to be on, second drafts across the board,
I
think there will at least be a final draft, which is, what gets voted on. Like, we have to have the voting members at the end have to kind of vote. That will, I dare say, even if it's only technical, it'll have additional changes. It'll have penalties, right? Coming through the summer. So there will be after this kind of March draft, there will be at least one more kind of big comprehensive, final draft for voting. There may be intermediate ones too, depending on, and that's more like how much are things in flux? I mean, obviously there are a lot of issues where we just, people have different positions and
there you go. And, you know, we'll take our best shot at navigating those. And, you know, additional comments or, you know, just like kind of beating the same drum. But to the extent that there's still like new insights, right? I think is an issue that we have all along, seeing how things interconnect with like any change, for instance, to involuntary intoxication, right? You know, if that was significantly changed, well, then that's going to have ripple effects, you know. The other kind of big thing, again, is penalties, right? And once, you know, people start to see numbers, does that seem, you know, how does that work with the gradations? Does that seem scary? Does that seem good? Does it, you know, that will, I think, in a very practical way, cause people to have a new set of comments on all sides. And again, don't expect us to get full agreement on anything. And particularly, what one thing we've said with penalties, we may end up coming up with a couple of sets of like two sets of recommendations to move forward with. So, yeah, big picture. So yes, thank you for coming.
You
feel free
much.
To step out. Feel free to grab a little cake anyway.
Yes, thank you for the cake,
Rachel. Baby.
Yeah, exactly. Watch out for the baby.
Thank you, Dr.
Again,
yeah.
There's got to be a crime in there somewhere about swallowing a baby. There's got to be something's wrong. Failure to arrest.
Oh, sorry.
Well, sorry. Oh, let me sorry. Just kind of go through. This may very well be it, but I failure to arrest for withdrawal defense. Anything more folks had there? I don't think we had any comments on failure to arrest. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Okay. And
despite the massive number of prosecutions for failure to arrest.
You know, I will note our data did show at least some charges. If not, I don't remember if there were convictions under this. And that's interesting in itself, right? Like it's an interesting offense.
I'd love to see the fact pattern.
You'd love to see the personnel record on the officer.
Yeah.
that's exactly right.
I was wondering if it was, you know, one officer failing to arrest another officer for something.
Or a sergeant saying, go arrest him. The guy goes, no.
Yeah.
Which is a whole different kind of non-arrest than...
Yeah.
Interesting.
Who knows? Who knows? But I think it's a, you know, it's an oddity. Obviously, it, given current differences in law on things like marijuana, it raises all sorts of interesting fact patterns. So, good. Moving then out of the comments to the kind of forward-looking, again, I don't know where people might be in their reviews. You know, we've had some conversations, but I know federal folks might be still catching up on the new set of stuff.
We are.
So, you know, again, feel free to, like, contact us.
It was very hard. I mean, I know this is important.
You're digging out from the snowstorm.
Did this qualify?
This did not qualify for my accepted work, nor
or second or third pile. It was
exactly.
The fourth, fifth pile, yeah. Fair enough. And, you know, I think, you know, hopefully this is, you know, doable in the timeline. I will flag to, you know, the de minimis defense is something that, you know, is more conceptual, right? You know, this raises a number of other kind of bigger picture policy conceptual issues, and also particular drafting. And one thing I would really make a plea for on the de minimis defense is if anybody has, again, specific language tweaks, right, for the de minimis defense that would help address, you know,
whatever
concerns that you have. Because I think, so just put that out there, that particular language tweaks. Because this is something that, again, as one begins to imagine how it would actually be applied in practice, you know, what's the jury instruction look like? At that level, it may be that there are questions or concerns, and something in the statute
could address that. So just flag that. Otherwise, and the other last thing I do, the second draft of report number 9, to avoid confusion, it is not a full redo of, you know, number 9 or updating theft to incorporate, for instance, some of the other comments we've had. It's on the narrow point. This is just to add into the kitty this narrow point about theft from a person and how that was a piece as we kind of carved up traditional robbery, right? That the theft from a person, the very bottom end, now goes over there, right? Where there's no use of force, essentially, against the person, right?
Pickpocketing.
Yeah, the pickpocketing, or not even
or
that, right?
Like, possession. Right.
Or just like, you know, it was, yeah, yeah, the bike behind you, right, sort of thing. That now is right in the theft from a person. But the write-up for that and what we've queued up is not, again, like a full revised version of theft. It's really just on this one point of here's adding into the gradations some language to reflect this kind of theft from person. So that's a relatively narrow point that comes up in that second draft of report number 9. Thank you all. I assume there's nothing more then, and we'll call it a wrap. And feel free to follow up with any questions or concerns.